Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Paul Lawrence, and today's conversation is with Dr. David Chu. David is the Undersecretary of Defense for Personnel and Readiness for the Department of Defense. And joining us in our conversation is Bill Phillips.
David, in our last segment, you were talking about strategic planning with regard to human capital transformation and a number of those things. Your current planning talks about a capabilities-based workforce.
Yes, sir.
And that model. Talk to us about that, and how is it changing the way the department does its business?
Of course, in the Cold War, we faced a single, or often thought we faced a single major opponent, and we had a well-defined idea about how that opponent might act and threaten our interests. And so, if I may use a sort of economist jargon, we had a point solution to every problem. We could optimize. We could pick what we thought was the best answer because we thought we knew what the problem was we had to solve. Now we face a different world where the threats are not as clearly defined, where we may face over time a very different kind of problem, one that we can't fully now foresee, as I think the events of September 11th illustrated. So we're much more into a portfolio management problem, if I may continue the analogy, where we have to hedge against a variety of possible outcomes. I'll give you an example, practical example that I'm struggling with right now, language training. What kind of language capacity do we want our military and civil workforce to have? Indeed, what kind of language resources will the Department of Defense need over time? Now, 15, 18 months ago, no one would have forecast that finding the Pashtun speakers in the military ranks would be a high priority task for the personnel system. Now, of course, we'll take every Pashtun speaker we can discover. And yet you can't keep every possible language on hand. So how do you get the capability here to interact with a variety of societies, some of them very different from the United States, certainly very different from Western European notions of what's a state, what's the role of government, and so on and so forth. How would you function in this society? And we need to be able to solve that problem, to have the capability to operate wherever on the globe the president might send the military forces of the United States. So it is a matter of being able to act effectively in a wide range of circumstances whose specific parameters we can't foresee that now constitutes the problem we must solve. And what we're really coming to is, I think, a conclusion. To do so, you've got to have a range of capacities within your institution, not just something optimized for one particular problem. And if you optimize one problem, it's like the watch that is stopped. It will be accurate twice a day, but it will be useless the rest of the time. Much better have a timepiece that's perhaps not quite so precise, but that's more or less on the mark across the entire 24 hours, and that's where you want to try to take the department.
You have a number of initiatives in place to improve quality of life. Could you talk to us about those and describe how they're impacting readiness and recruiting and those elements?
It's a critical issue for both the military and civil personnel of the department. The military side, I think, it's something that's long been recognized. The military has a saying that goes something like, retention decisions are made at the kitchen table. That it really isn't the retention non-commissioned officer that's doing the job. It's what the family decides is right for them. And that means it's not simply a matter of what is the work responsibility of the military member. It's also what happens to the family. And that affects all aspects of their lives. Several are, of course, more salient than others. One is housing. State of military housing is not good. The president spoke to that during his campaign and has emphasized it since. It's one of the items of his personal interest. Our problem is that we have an old housing stock for those who use military houses. It was built, much of it, to the standards of the 1950s. And to think back on what those standards were, usefully recall what was a Levittown house. Levittown, as you know, was the late 40s, Long Island, first suburbia kind of development. And it had just under 1,000 square feet, and it had one bathroom. There was no such thing as a family room, breakfast nook, or any of that sort of thing. There was only a one-car garage. That's not the standard that American families aspire to today. What have we done? Starting with the last administration, and I have to give a lot of credit both to Congress and our predecessors in this, they realized that we couldn't do that all ourselves. And there was time to turn to the resource of the private sector and to offer them essentially a long-term lease kind of proposition on government land in which they would build the houses and we would give them a preferential opportunity to rent those houses to our people. So we have a vast set of housing privatization efforts out there right now. What does that do for us? First of all, it brings the capital of the private sector to bear, so the government doesn't have to raise the capital right away. Second, it brings the skill of the private sector in figuring out what the housing, what do people really want in the house. We're not necessarily all that good at it, and we shouldn't probably be writing those specifications. We want a result, which is we want a happy set of families. You tell me what they're going to like. Here's how much money they can spend, because everybody knows what the housing allowance is going to look like. What's in it for the developer? Well, we have a good set of customers. Our people pay on time, because, in fact, what we'll do is just send the housing allowance directly from the Treasury to the developer if you occupy the house. The developer still has to compete, typically, under these arrangements. He has to build a house or a condo-type unit that's attractive enough that those families want to say, yes, I'd like to live in this. And so he's got a strong incentive to build a good community. And typically in these arrangements, he has a 25-year lease, maybe with an option to roll over another 25 years in certain refreshment standards. They're fairly complex vehicles, but they're very imaginative. And the results, at least so far, are extremely promising. You can go to these various bases, an excellent set at Fort Carson as one example. They're great houses. Military families are delighted to live in them. They're nice communities. The developer has a strong interest in making a successful community because he wants to fill it with these high-end families that come armed with their housing allowance, which means there's no vacancy rate, there's no cash flow problem, there's no delinquent payment issue for him. It's a win-win situation for everyone. So that's just one example of how we have to respond to what our people aspire to. We can't just stick them in a 1950s Levittown house, even if it's, quote, free, and assume they're going to be happy.
Healthcare costs are rising throughout the country, and I'm assuming the Department of Defense is no exceptions. What are the major concerns about healthcare in the department?
Well, the big transition in healthcare in defense was the move to a managed care-like paradigm in the late 80s, early 90s, which we call TRICARE. The early years, to be candid, were not a happy situation. We had a lot of performance issues. We're proud of how far we've come over this last 10 years. We treat this just as a private sector healthcare operation would. We do surveys of our patients after their last visit. We send them a questionnaire and say, what about this last visit? How'd you feel about it? We're very proud of our scores. We're right up there just about where the better private plans are in terms of patient satisfaction with the encounter that they've had. We do face the same challenge the civil sector faces, and that is the rapid rise of healthcare costs, although we're very proud of the fact that this past fiscal year, for the first time in 4 or 5 years, we finished the year within our budget. And that relates to a major management effort we've made, as the Congress likes to phrase, to optimize the mix of resources we bring to delivery of healthcare, to improve how well we use both the contracts we have as well as the set of military treatment facilities, hospitals and clinics that are government-owned and government-operated and are staffed by government personnel. Often we had a bad match in a particular local market. And increasingly, the way we're going to try to deal with the cost issues over time is to view the healthcare system as a set of important local markets. Each one has different conditions. For defense, there are 15 or 20 really big ones around the country. Washington, D.C. is an example. Norfolk, Virginia is an example. San Diego is an example. Fort Hood is an example. San Antonio is an example. In other words, a place where we've got a lot of people, and we have a significant number of assets, both government and purchase character, and the issue for us is how to put those together in the best possible fashion. We'll be appointing a set of market leaders, market managers, really, mm-hmm. who will be the guru for that area, and with certain powers to reallocate resources and reapply resources within that small region to get the best outcome for our people and the best deal for the government.
Does the changing nature of the population, its age and its size, pose different complexities for managing health care?
Absolutely. We have an older patient population now than was true 20 years ago because a lot higher fraction is composed of retirees and their families. And of course, as you know, Congress made a decision 2 or 3 years ago to extend the TRICARE benefit to those who are otherwise Medicare eligible. Prior law had said once you became Medicare eligible, you dropped out of our system except insofar as we had space available in a military hospital. That led to an outcry on the part of the retirees as they reached 65. Congress reacted by saying, okay, they're eligible too. So within the last 18 months, we've rolled out what's called TRICARE for life, starting October 1st a year ago. The pharmacy part actually started a little bit before that. And it's, a great tribute to the people working in the military healthcare system. They made this all work. This is a huge, this is hundreds of thousands of additional households for which we suddenly became responsible, and the whole issue of paying their bills as second payer to Medicare. So it was a significant financial transaction operation to manage here. And it has gone, I think, at least we believe, quite well in terms of that transition. People are generally satisfied with the outcome. But yes, it is a population that's much older on average than was true before, and we suddenly added all these much older families. So we've got a whole new set of issues to deal with in terms of how we manage the system, including, you know, some of these things you don't think of in advance in terms of what public administration requires, including the whole question of eligibility. The way the military medical system works, to be eligible, you have to have a military ID card. Well, many older retiree families, especially surviving widows, hadn't had an ID card in years. In fact, had no idea they were supposed to apply for an ID card because there was no benefit to them doing so. So we have a big effort to get the word out and to help people who haven't had an ID card to get one so they can be in the system. And it's not so much the card per se that's critical. They have to be in our automated register, so to speak, so that when you come to a treatment facility, they say, oh, yes, here's Bill. He's on my list. We'll pay his bills. We'll cover his care.
That's a good stopping point. It's time for a break. Rejoin us in a few minutes as we continue our conversation about management with David Chu of the Department of Defense. This is the Business of Government Hour.